You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Greetings, everyone. My name is Sean Dove, and I am the manager of the Open Society Institute's campaign for Black Male Achievement. I want to welcome you to our brown bag lunch with Dr. Stephen Pitts, and today's topic is Black Labor in America, Emerging Opportunities Amid the Economic Crisis. And for those of you who don't know, about a year ago, actually in June of 2008, OSI launched its campaign for Black Male Achievement, which is a targeted cross-fund strategy to improve life outcomes for Black men and boys. And out of our recent strategic planning process, we've emerged with three core areas where we intend to do some targeted investments. And those areas are education, strengthening family structures, and also expanding work opportunities. And Dr. Pitts is one of our early grantees within the campaign. And just a word about Dr. Pitts before we turn the floor over to him. And he's intentionally said that he wants this to be a dialogue and a conversation, just doesn't want to do the presentation and with nodding heads and then question and answer. So it's kind of going to be like a church atmosphere, a little call and response. If he says something that you're feeling, you can say amen, or you can shout out and ask a question, and hopefully he won't be in a scenario where he's be careful what you ask for. You just might get it, but we really want this to be a conversation, right? We're on target there. Okay, Dr. Pitts is the co-author of Beyond the Mountaintop, King's Prescription for Poverty, and other reports detailing the state of work in the Black community. In 2006, he initiated the C.L. Dellums African American Union Leadership School in order to improve the skills of unionists interested in linking the labor movement and the Black community. In addition to being a grantee of our campaign for Black Male Achievement, Pitts is the lead on a two-year project funded by the Ford Foundation designed to improve relations between Blacks and Latino immigrants in the workplace. During this presentation today, he will focus on the current job crisis facing the Black community with an emphasis on Black men, campaign for Black male achievement, in the context of the current recession and the intersections with the immigration reform movement. And so I'd like to welcome Dr. Pitts, who I will add is on vacation and in from California visiting his sister, and we corralled him in to do this labor of love and share his work. So please join me in the campaign and welcome in Dr. Pitts.
Be very relaxed. I'm going to sit down and be relaxed if I can. And so two important things. Hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Try again. So two important things. I was born and raised in Chicago. And on my birth certificate says Stephen, not doctor. Just please call me Stephen, not doctor. But seriously, I was joking, but to me it's always kind of amusing how we are very serious about social change. We also get into hierarchies too. My father was a psychologist, by the way. It's kind of a deep issue y'all got, and so you need to kind of change it a little bit. He was a psychologist, and he had a PhD from U of Chicago back in the day where we didn't get those PhDs, right? But we weren't raised in that. Hear me, or because the light's popping on.
I could hear you better if you talked into the microphone.
I didn't know that this is projecting or this is recording.
Just pull it up a little bit closer.
How's that? A little clearer? Okay. So I go through my jokes again.
Don't worry, we're going to edit this, so it'll just flow right through.
So the other important thing is that part of my vacation mode is I love jazz, and my favorite singer of all time is Michelle Pharrell, who'd be the Blue Note tomorrow night. I would be there. I'll be the fool up there acting crazy on Rochelle. That'll be me, okay? So I'm going to come up from underground for about an hour and a half today and hopefully have a good conversation. I want this to be a conversation for a lot of reasons. I think we grow through the conversation. We don't grow by sitting there like on a chair, just listening. We grow through kind of engaging, you know, and I truly believe this is a friend's conversation. And so I hope that we can be open and honest, and that's how we kind of can learn from each other and go forward. Also, part of this data that I'm going to be presenting is kind of hot off the press, literally. So I was given this huge data set. I was given Excel data sets, maybe 335 occupations, around 200 some odd variables about 10 days ago. So it's hot off the press. I don't know what I'm looking at, by the way. So I want to kind of with you go through it some and see how it looks, how it flows, how the presentation goes and so forth. So seriously, I need that kind of feedback. I want to do a couple of things here. I want to talk about an overall frame for this whole topic about black labor and jobs and immigration. I want to then talk a bit about some data. And to me, the data is important. I mean, I am like Dr. Pitts, right? But the data is sometimes secondary because I truly believe that we go into our communities, folks there haven't seen the latest regression analysis. And they saw the little coefficient. Oh, my God, whatever. I mean, folk have real experiences, and then they'd be honored. But sometimes the problem is that we assume that our experience is the experience. And we move over anecdotes. But I'm clear that this data can help broaden the understanding. But more important is that conversation with everybody. So we get a sense of what's happening. So it's partially data-driven. So we have the data. But it's also partially telling a story where the larger picture fits in with people's personal experiences, and then we go forward. And so we'll start with kind of the framing issue, go to some data, and then close up and have us talk about what we should do about this stuff. So kind of three parts to the conversation. I guess Sean gave the best highlights about me. I've been at the Labor Center for 8 years now. The Labor Center, I mean, on here is the Center for Labor Research and Education. We say it's the Labor Center. It's been around for 45 years. And it's an outreach arm of the University of California, Berkeley. And our goal really is to take the resources of the university into the community. And really, it's kind of the labor community, both labor unions and CBOs doing labor work. What we say kind of under the table is that we're committed to bring power for working families to achieve social change. Don't write it down. Edit it out. We'll lose funding, okay, from the state. But the good thing about having the money in California, they can't take our money from us, y'all. So that's a good thing, at least. I can be more free for a little while, at least. But we do both research and trainings. And what I've done in the last 6 years or so, we try to develop a portfolio project on black workers and job quality. And it involves both some research that Sean alluded to, and it's on our website. Oh, by the way, our website. It's no www, just laborcenter.berkeley.edu. So if you go to find us, it's laborcenter, one word, .berkeley.edu. You can see some of the reports there. We also have a fascinating union leadership school that we've gone through 4 different cycles now, 8 sessions. And people go through every other Saturday, 8 sessions altogether, around some leadership development stuff. I think it's really promising, really powerful. And then we have the different technical assistance as well. The last thing I want to mention about me is I'm also on a couple of boards. People know the Center for Third World Organizing. I'm on the board of that organization. It's leading a lot of good stuff. I'm excited about that. And also a very dynamic group in San Francisco called Young Workers United that's trying to organize young folk in San Francisco around who are in low-wage work situations and so. So I kind of stay on campus, get my hands dirty, listen to jazz, watch basketball. Life's good, y'all. Okay. So instead of what I want to talk about, my thoughts on going beyond the current crises. And so let me do a couple things here. Look at this fancy thing here. That's what I just said we're going to do. By the way, because it's a vacation thing, all my little fancy transitions on there, so bear with me. This is kind of the low-tech version. But I'm going to do those 3 things, okay? And as I said, I want us to have a conversation. It's roughly a half-hour per section. We can kind of flow. But don't just sit there. Because my goal is always, y'all, I want us to learn and grow. And my choice was simply talk for 2 hours straight. Or, no, be resting. I would rather rest. Okay? And so my value comes from us coming together. Seriously, though. So feel free to kind of engage wherever you feel the need. So part one, the overarching frame. Look in the context. I talk about this being the Obama moment, but in the age of immigrants. And what I mean is this. Last year was phenomenal. I mean, I spent the last 10 days in the Cleveland campaign, and that was like just... That was great, y'all. I mean, it's just phenomenal in so many ways. And seeing the enthusiasm around in Cleveland, knowing how all of us got jazz behind is phenomenal. I will never forget the concert before the inauguration because I love music. And seeing all the stuff was phenomenal. That was great. But really, that kind of flowering of democracy is taking place in a larger sort of thing. See, people, things are changing. But the context of the change is the incredible change in demographics. So we're truly in the age of immigrants. And I use it in this sense. I was reading a book by a man named George Lipsitz, and he was talking about how if we talk about great kind of democratizing moments in this country, that one incredible democratizing moment was the 30s, okay, called the age of the CIO, where it wasn't just the union, but working people came forward. We saw expansion of rights and expansion of democracy. It was clearly imperfect, though, right? So we saw in the 60s another big democratic moment. He called the age of the civil rights movement, where once again, led by African-Americans, we saw another expansion of democracy in this country. And so given that I kind of like democracy, the small deal, I said, well, what's going to be the next big mass movement? I think truly it's going to be the issue of immigration and immigrants. And that's what's going to fuel the next big surge of democracy in this country. Now, just as it was messy in the 30s and messy in the 60s, it's going to be messy, y'all, okay, today. But still, that's the context for the changes we're going through. So I call this the Obama moment, but not the man, y'all. It's the context that an incredible change in the demographics of this country. But also, I think it's important to talk about blackness in the 21st century. Being kind of old, I'll be 56 in July, y'all, okay, being kind of old. I remember back in the day, right? And what concerned me about some things today is that oftentimes in discussion of the change in people of color, black folks turn invisible in that conversation, y'all, okay? And too oftentimes, that's damaging for a whole bunch of reasons. And so I think we need to be explicit. But we need to have a clear discussion of blackness in the 21st century. In other words, people, race is different than before, but still is important. Okay. If you think about kind of the oppressive yoke of slavery and Jim Crow, given that kind of crucible, an amazing set of black institutions developed to allow us to thrive and survive and transform society. Now, that is gone, y'all. That was back in the day. But it doesn't mean that times are idyllic. And so the challenge is to look at blackness in the current time period, and given that, what all the institutions and practices that emerge from that in the new world, right? And allow people to survive and thrive and hopefully transform as well. So to me, it's kind of the overarching frame that we do have this new moment, this larger age, but the question is also the issue of blacks in the 21st century. But the imperative is twofold. I think one, how y'all doing now? One imperative is what I call, what we know about people, is the unfinished revolution. That what happened in the 60s and 70s, say 50s, the modern civil rights movement was phenomenally powerful. It was incomplete. And so one clear task is to finish the revolution. And it's important because I think that when you talk about the distress that's happened in our communities, part of the source of the distress is the knowledge of that incompleteness. And the question is, well, we weren't taken care of, now they are being taken care of. And so we have to take care of that unfinished business. But at the same time now, people, we have a 21st century vision of social change. That's the other key imperative to achieve that new world, a new world order, you could say. And what I'm thinking more and more about this, people, if you don't have a progressive black presence, we won't achieve that new social vision. That's a really important point, different conversation. A couple of examples, people. To me, one important thing that needs to be done is you need to have all people in this country have some sort of official ID card. Things need to roll that way, y'all, okay? It's particularly important. Now, in Oakland, they had a big campaign to get a municipal ID card, and it passed city council. Everyone voted for it but two. One person abstained, one voted against it. Who abstained? A black person city council. Who voted against it? Black person city council. So I'm saying we have this vision of social change. Yeah, we can talk about the conversation, but we can't want to. My point, though, is that I think most of us, we carve out a vision of social change. Sometimes our leaders aren't there. So we need really a progressive social movement, so we black social movement, so we can have this larger vision taking place. That's my sense of the imperative. I want to put forth kind of eight theses on the state of black workers. A friend of mine said, well, Martin Luther had 95 or something. I'm way, way short of Martin Luther, y'all, okay? I said eight here. But I want to give you some thoughts on kind of black workers. One question is why do I focus on black workers? One reason from the perspective of immigration, a major source of anxiety is around the question of jobs. And so if we want to talk about the issue of the anxiety around immigration, we have to talk about the question of jobs as well and black workers. But also, I think that, you know, race is a very, very fluid concept. You know, kind of our academic term is that it's a social construction. And if that's the case, it means that blackness takes place not in some sort of universality, but in concrete situations. And so you can understand blackness by understanding black workers and black women and black youth and so forth, not in some generalities. And so my piece is, let's understand black workers. And then finally, most black folks are workers, y'all. We work. Most folks can't sit back and be Oprah, okay? We gotta earn some money, right? And so it means that when you understand black workers, you understand a key dimension of black life. And so I try to look at that. Y'all, people, you're way too quiet, by the way, you know. So feel free to chime in with an amen, or preferably let me push back a little bit, okay?
Waiting for the food.
Waiting for the food? But my fear
which
is
coming.
Get all settled and feeling good and fat and lazy at that point. And it's a real problem pop up at that point, okay? Thesis one. I think the black community faces a two-dimensional crisis around jobs, okay? It's the real crisis of unemployment, but also the crisis of low-wage work. That's a much, much longer conversation, but I think that if you think about how we normally approach the question of jobs in our community, we focus on just one, unemployment. Now, this is clearly a pre-recession thesis, okay? We can't ignore unemployment, but also people, black folks work on buses, in hospitals, with security offices, with cashiers, with clerks, with cooks, by the way, too. And so we work, we get up every day, we don't get paid well. And that's the other important crisis. And because of the near singular focus on employment, we ignore the other crises. Now, I'm not saying we should ignore unemployment. I'm not saying we need to have more of a balanced view. Now, clearly, in certain situations, one rises to the top. I wouldn't try to deny what's happening now, y'all. But still, as we'll talk about later on, we've got to understand the other issue there about low-wage work and not just get black folks into bad-paying jobs. Now, that's the importance that we're talking about both elements there, that we haven't reached heaven when we have somebody in a McDonald's job, where McDonald's is currently constructed. Now, if we've got better-paying jobs, we can talk about McDonald's jobs, y'all. Right now, that's not heaven, okay? And so we have two things to look at. Keep going.
Speaking to the mic, Delroy.
Yeah, I was asking about the impact of skill set, because, I mean, I'm with you on the unemployment and the lower wage, but I think that if you drill down deeper, there's a discussion that needs to be had regarding skill set.
Can we have 5 hours, y'all, for this conversation? when the food gets here, okay, we have a five-hour conversation. Yes, skills are very important. Clothing, I mean, I am Dr. Pitcher. I like education. It's important, right? I think the one thing we talk about, the totality, we put a lot of emphasis on unemployment, important to do that. A lot of emphasis on skills, folk got to read and write, those sort of things. But when we talk about the wages that people receive, it's not just a function of skill sets. It's also a function of the power that exists in the labor market. And that's the piece we don't talk a lot about. And that's why I'm trying to raise that up a little bit. And so we have kind of this narrative about black life trajectories, how, you know, folk were, you know, my folk born in Alabama, went to Chicago, folk were born, places in North Carolina, New York, Texas, out of California, that kind of trajectory, and got good-paying jobs. Those jobs, be it in the steel mills or in the auto factory, those are union jobs. There weren't anything inherently good about those jobs. They were made good-paying jobs. And so while skills are very important, we can't forget that we can take other jobs that are low paying and make them better paying jobs. But the classic example today is if you go to Vegas, if y'all stop partying too much and talk to the people who work there, okay, they get paid well because they are unionized. And so what I'm trying to emphasize here is the fact that we got to examine power, and not just individual power. What skills do is give individuals power, clearly important. I mean, we wouldn't conclude denying that. But I think the one lesson we know about our history is that we also need to have collective power. And when you speak of that in the context of wages, that means you want to have black folk with other folk working, fighting together for higher pay. So very important. Wouldn't want to ignore that. I tend to downplay, give my little bias, okay, but clearly it's important. But I'll raise up the other element as well. It's not just the issue of individual advancement. It's the collective advancement. And the workplace, it means certain things. That's kind of my thought. You can push it on.
Well, as a people,
yeah.
As a culture,
uh-huh.
Do you think that we've been continuing to take the long road in regards to skill set? I guess I'm focusing on skill set because I have a background with human resources administration. Out of it was just a numbers game, you know, where let's get them jobs, but there wasn't really a concern about the type of job. It was like just get them employed. And so I have an issue with that because I feel that when are we going to kind of get it that, okay, the skill set can take you there from an individual perspective and how that is going to kind of work in with what you're talking about in terms of the job crisis.
So two things.
This is not in the presentation at all. But if you examine what happened in the tail part of the 1990s, when we began to become close to a full employment economy, everybody had a job, y'all. Okay? It wasn't also how folk got smart. Because you had a growing economy, and folk got sucked into the economy. So skills plus some other stuff needs to be talked about. Also, if you kind of track the trajectory of wages over time, you see across all levels of education, the improvement in income is slacking off a little bit. So still you see like a skill premium there, that's what you're talking about, it's still there, yeah. But it's less now because you're operating in an economy that doesn't treat individual workers well. Mm-hmm. So it may do better by a PhD than a high school dropout, okay? But if you compare to, you know, today to before, we have these pressures in our larger economy that is driving down wages across the board.
We're on the first thesis, and I know, Stephen, you said you want this to be conversational, but we're only on the first thesis, so I want to kind of, like, move, and we can get the question and answers. I'm not, you know, squashing the question and answers, but I want to get through at least. I want to see the second thesis, all right? Okay.
The question was, issue was that we always will have low-wage jobs. And given that, how do you kind of perform in today's economy where you have or always have low-wage jobs? That's kind of the essence of what you're saying. Now, I can't get long. I'm going to squash my long answer. But I simply push back on there always will be. It's a function of a lot of things. So I teach economics. And when we talk about economics, this supply curve, demand curve, wage pops out. That's missing the larger context. What I'm going to keep having us bring here is a larger context of why jobs are paid poorly. It's not just a function of skill. It's not because it has to be. It's also a function of power as well. But let me keep going on 2 through 8, okay, given that. No problem. The second, as we're kind of talking about, there's a disproportionate amount of resources devoted to addressing the crisis of unemployment relative to the crisis of low-wage jobs. So if we did a survey of New York City, who's doing job stuff? Good job stuff, right? I would say most folk are trying to take folk who don't have a job, get them into a job. Most folks are doing that. Few people are saying, how can I take a current job and make it better? So I'm swapping the analysis. So the idea of making someone unemployed to a job holder says, I want to move individual from state of the world A to state of the world B, right? No job to a job. Low wage job to good job. I'm saying, how about saying taking a job, making a better job? So if we put a lot of emphasis on the individual, it's important. We don't put a lot of emphasis on the context and how do we, through organizing and public policy, approve the nature of those jobs. That was fast, wasn't it? Similarly, a disproportionate amount of resources are devoted to addressing the needs of individuals relative to addressing the fundamental structural sources of the job crisis. So it's kind of heavy repetitive of our conversation we're having here, right? That we spend a lot of good, important time on individuals. We don't talk about, wait a second, what's in the structure of our economy that's turning out these bad jobs, low-wage jobs? If you examine industries that are relatively place-based. In other words, some industries can do what they do any place in the world, y'all. They're footloose and fancy-free, okay? Some are anchored in a place. As you are not going to Beijing for McDonald's, y'all, okay? Certain things you got to have here, right, to do them, right? If we examine those place-based industries, a lot of black workers are in those industries. It's important because if a job is footloose and fancy-free, it's difficult to change the nature of that job because if you try to, if you push back, they're gonna flee, right? But if a job is relatively place-based, they got to be here. Now, I'm not saying take McDonald's, make them pay $50 an hour, y'all, okay? I'm not that stupid, okay? But the idea is you could up the wage, though, because they got to be there. And so it's important to focus not just on people, but on structures and examine how to transform those industries that aren't going anywhere.
Industries such as, you mentioned McDonald's, fast food.
Retail okay. is one, okay? Nothing's permanent place over time. Things change, right? But retail is an example. Healthcare is an example. Logistics and warehousing is another example. Okay, looking at retail hospitality, another example. But these are kind of places that's kind of stuck because if we have global trade, we're gonna have some dock shell. Okay, gotta have a warehouse. Okay, if I gotta catch a cold, I'm not going to Mexico City, y'all. Okay, I'm going to Oakland, Kaiser. Okay, and so those are mean kind of place-based industries that they can be transformed.
Doctor, brother, fellow aficionado of jazz, Stevie Fitz. My question, and I'm from Cleveland, so you really speak to a lot of my upbringing. Looking at the factories over time diminishing output in terms of worker output and, as well as employment. The question is, how much of a bigger picture cultural tradition of the first generation coming up in these factories raising families and emphasizing a different way of coming up has impacted the way in which we approach the individual versus changing the structure? Or is that at all in play?
I don't fully understand the question. Run through me again.
You mentioned that an inadequate number of resources are placed on shifting the structure, but that the majority of resources change the position of an individual from having no job to having a job. It seems from my experience and some observations that the generations of black workers who really embraced union jobs as well as these types of, I don't even want to say lower paying because I've seen whole families raised off of them. There was a sense of being discouraged away from pursuing those types of opportunities. And I just wonder if there was a critical mass of individuals who did not pursue those jobs going forward that could have had a role in these companies making these decisions to go elsewhere.
A lot of things. Let me untie some stuff and address part of it. And so you had kind of this history where you had a kind of industrial economy. And given that sort of situation around economy, given you had these huge factories, it was easier to organize. And so you did organize unions there. You got better paying jobs. And folks didn't want their kids in the mills. Okay, they didn't come near those mills. Some people said that, right? And they told kids that we could finance, go to school, those sort of things. I think a couple things happened. One is that you had a change in our economy where kind of the old unionized base went away. You also have, as we know, kind of the erosion in the old-time civil society. So those sort of institutions and networks that stitched us together and promoted the kind of survival and struggle that also went away. And so if those things are going away kind of an industrial context, and I call it a family context, kind of family meaning larger family context, mm-hmm. then what's going to happen is more and more individual struggle. People, we always had that, by the way. We may elevate the marches, but we're also together themselves as well. Okay, so we always had both things going on, but now the kind of the fertile ground for the collective is less. So we see a rising, you might say, of the individuals. Okay, no problem. We need to look at how we can shift toward a focus on job transformation as a central goal. In other words, how do we improve the quality of jobs to help our black workers? That needs to be the central issue. You raised it in some ways, right, where don't give any old job, right? Give them a good job, which is important. That's an important question to raise. Some people don't raise that question at all. Raise the question, how do we get folks into good jobs?
I just have a question regarding this piece right here. Is this
speaking to the mic.
Is this something that you feel is becoming politically correct? Like years ago, there was a shift in the emphasis on being socially responsible by corporate America. But this is really interesting, the whole job transformation piece, because from an individual perspective, we are encouraged to increase our quality of life. So when you spin it, how do you increase the quality of the job? Do you find that this is something that is being embraced by corporate America?
Probably not them, because they want to maximize profits, and quality. Since quality kind of reduces profits, that's not a good idea. But outside of corporate America, I think you raised the question in different terms. You said your experience has been they train people for any old job, then you have good jobs. That's rephrasing, I think, this orientation, quality jobs. Honestly, we talk about how do you do more union organizing, another manifestation of that orientation. I think more and more is coming up. People talk more about underemployment now, right? It's the same thing. Because we mean by unemployment, folks can't pay the bills, right? I got a job, can't pay the bills. So I think it is kind of coming more and more to the surface in different ways. It may not be these words, but it doesn't need to be these words, y'all. It's the impulse. It says, every time we do something in my sphere of life, how do I find ways to make jobs better? I mean, one little digression, that was the beauty of the Obama campaign. Everybody played a role, right? You gave $5, you gave $50, right? You gave $5,000, you made one phone call, went to Queens for 10 days. Folks plugged in at the way they could plug in. It seems to be a similar sort of thing. That how you plug in is up to you. You got a job, you do what you can do. The issue is plug in a way to push forward the idea of improving the structure of jobs and getting folks into good paying jobs. I think it's getting there more and more. Yeah. So even we have a struggle for better access. So job access, we talked about lowering unemployment. You got to raise the question that we're talking about now, right? How do we get black workers into a job into good jobs? It's not just any old jobs, it's the good jobs, okay? One big battle that's taking place over on Walmart, right? The simple saying, well, folks need a Walmart job is a step up, right? There's no career ladder out of Walmart, y'all, okay? And so the issue is not just getting any old job, it's a good paying job and you need to focus.
And just describe a good job. What's a good job?
Now, and I'm trying to, I fell back my little vacation rhetoric, so I say low wage jobs, but I said it, let's talk about it. So in my kind of quantitative approach, I highlight these your wages. The folks are able to pay the bills, okay? And so that means that's a principal characteristic. We could talk about other things as well. Benefits are important too. We can talk about kind of having due process on the job. So due process power, community audience, that needs to be there. The idea of being flexible. So one problem that college students have, they got to work, right? They got to make the hours in classes too. They can't miss get the two fitting okay. I mean, they have flexible hours sometimes. So I think start with wages, go to benefits, go to due process. Then we can talk about other things as well, like flexibility and those things. I think another positive thing about this job, this is number 7, by the way, another positive thing about this job transformation orientation is that it provides a point of unity with immigrant workers who also want good jobs, y'all. And my concern with the highlighting job access, people now fight over a job. But if you highlight job quality, you unite folks and say, we all want a good paying job. So we talk about divisions. Oftentimes, we know how we express, how we frame, can either expand divisions or help minimize divisions. I think that the job transformation approach, in this context, how to get better jobs, quality jobs, can unite more than divide. Lastly, it implies a practical focus on organizing, not just individualized job training. People. In my worst moments, I do either or. That's my worst moments, y'all. It is not either or. It's both are important. Okay? We got to have good job training. Folk got to know how to read. They need to do the math, y'all. They got to know how to get up and work on time. My thing, put a belt on, use it right, those sort of things, okay? But beyond those individual things, you also need to have organized to increase the capacity of folk to transform those environments as well. Both are important. So two questions. How do we organize for better public policies to protect and raise labor standards? And second, how do we organize, how do we support organizing amongst workers to increase the power in the workplace? Those are two important basic questions we should ask. How do we pass laws that kind of put a standard in the labor market, like people in minimum wage law? There's a standard, okay? How do we get more of those things there? And second, how do we empower workers themselves? So part two. I'm on time. My schedule, Michelle.
Okay. Good.
So you don't have to question me at all. You can keep on talking now, okay? The data part. People, this is kind of what I call the greatest hits of data. This is a lot that could be there, but I don't want you going to sleep. I just want to give you kind of flavor of certain things. And this will be written up, by the way, meaning this larger stuff we have going on, when we can talk about. But this is really a function of two different projects. One, that Sean's funding, that we're trying to get a better sense of blacks in those place-based industries. So we have a different view of globalization, global economies. And then the Ford research on kind of the issue of, like a better term, kind of job displacement between immigrants and African Americans. So you get kind of a collapse in two data sets and get kind of the greatest hits. So going to the recession. So we see that clearly we have some over and some underrepresentation in certain industries for black men. This is, we're looking at data taken from the American Community Survey. We pulled together 2005, 6, and 7, the one data set. And so in that case, black men are 5.2% of the workforce from that kind of that data set, okay? And so we see kind of an overrepresentation in transportation utilities. That sector we see 11.3% of black men. And we see black men are underrepresented in financial activities, 3.6. And also education and health services, 3.1. So we see kind of the split, right? A whole lot in one, not a lot in another. Same sort of picture looking at black women, different industries, though. And so black women are 6.2% of the workforce. We see overrepresentation in education and health services and public administration, and underrepresentation, construction, and manufacturing. Here, one comment, y'all, that I want to make now that I haven't figured out how to resolve the question, that's the people who are incarcerated. That's a major hole in all this kind of stuff. So let you know, y'all, don't ask me what happened about it. I don't know right now, okay? That our data sets that we use normally can't address that question. It's a major problem. It's a major, major problem. I don't know up to it. I confess. Let's roll best we can given that, okay? So a sense, and we clearly have more numbers on different industries itself. What I want to do, by the way, is I may mention that for occupations, we've gotten it broken down by 365 occupations. Kind of a whole lot, y'all. I haven't got the breakdowns of industries yet, but we can do them eventually and show in a more final way where we are in certain industries. The reason why I like the industry analysis is that public policy and structural solutions are better focused on industries, while the individual stuff focuses on occupations. Both are important, by the way. I think from the point of view of an individual, we think of an occupation, right? I can do something here or there. I got some skills, right? But from a larger policy focus, oftentimes is easily able to influence industries than occupations. Yeah.
I had a question.
Mike.
I just had a question. Within the industry data and the breakdown, are you able to discern who has, you know, control over hiring? You know, because, you know, these numbers to me just represent, you know, our presence in the industry. But ultimately, you want to know at the end of the day, you know, who has, you know, control over hiring? Who's, you know, looking at the skill set and saying, okay, it's important for us to have, you know, black workers on our staff as opposed to, you know, all things being equal in terms of the skill set. I'd rather have, you know, this person working for me for whatever reason.
This can't. So clearly we can't go and talk about who's managers, okay? But the bottom lines, the things you're asking, we can't do that. So we could take a category of managers and say, what's the ethnic breakdown? That's part of your question. Let them fully address what you're saying, though. You want end of the day, right? Oftentimes titles exist, but power doesn't exist. Okay, you're raising a question of power, not titles. So no, this can't get to power issues now. Because you asked a question raising the actual power.
Yeah, I just want to know, my little badge, you know, it's right? Important, you know, to look at, you know, how do we, you know, who's going to change the structure? Well, then who has the power to do that? You know, so I guess.
So I'm raising two things here, because what you didn't say, but I tend to kind of build a straw man. I'm going to build a straw man out of your stuff. The title's not important, the power is. And there's two important kind of powers. One is kind of the individual can simply flip the switch. And you might be leading that direction. I want to push this beyond the individual pushing the switch in other structures. And so sometimes you can mandate certain things happening, which to me we need to be heading towards that in many industries. In some places, unions have control over job access. And so to me the question is not just an individual who I keep saying pull the lever, is how do you have structures that, or institutions that can set up to generate better outcomes? I'm going to push beyond just getting a sense of who's in the human resource department. You need a job on it, no problem. But make sure we're clear that it's beyond just that. It's the things going more than that. Question? Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, it's voice activated.
Okay. I'm Brandon Ray, Wall Street Alpha's Charitable Foundation. I'm just going back to what you talked about, Steve. You seem to focus a lot on regards to just trying to improve the quality of jobs. And, you know, that's definitely essential. Like, I'm unemployed, so good quality of job is definitely, you know, there. But, you know, when we inaugurated this president, unemployment was at 7.2%. African Americans was at 11%. So right now I think he's just trying to put a Band-Aid over hemorrhaging and just trying to stop it somewhere. When you put $1 billion with DOT, 35,000 jobs are created. In regards, I know we have to focus on the quality of job, but do you don't think it's just as important just to kind of put jobs in place?
So these are kind of pre-recession theses. Mm-hmm. And so the balance changes, okay? The emphasis may change. But I keep saying, and Obama said the same thing, that you got to get it right, though, okay? And so I use the analogy of how, and some data here later on, that for the last 35 years, the economy didn't work well for working folk. It just didn't do that. Wages didn't rise much, and those sort of things. So we were living in a house with a hole in the roof, y'all. And the hole was not having good incomes. And then we put a tarp on the roof. What it meant that people got second and third jobs. That's the first kind of patch we did, right? Then the next patch was that folks started using credit cards, right? The third patch was because I bought off our homes. Mm. And then the hurricane came, y'all, and blew the roof off. And the story here is that we don't want to put a new roof with a hole in it. We need a new roof. And so, yes, we do need to create jobs. But we also got to set up a structure so that it works well. So we don't want to go back to 1999 America. And it's working well. That didn't serve most folks. So my thing is, gotta get it right. And to me, the good analogy about the Great Depression, they did try to get it right. They restructured the banks in the 30s, right? They had a massive student program, World War II, okay? I mean, people talked about restructuring and creating really the social safety net then too. They got it right. And he's watching the same thing, getting it right this time with healthcare, the green stuff. So to me, it's not just the job creation. It's part of the story. It's getting the whole thing right again so we can have the economy look better for folks.
And one thing, also I was honored to find out that your co-author, professor of mine, Dr. Spriggs at Howard, he's very passionate about Reaganomics and what it hasn't done and what it has and what it hasn't done. You know, Reaganomics, very laissez-faire, blaming African Americans on the cause of poverty. This administration's very hands-on, saying we need to do everything we can. What works better, not for, I guess, the baby boomers, which, you know, but I'm really thinking about those that are graduating college like last week and try to, you know, get into this job pool or go to grad school and then maybe have opportunities. What works well? Hands-on government, hands-off government.
Who's going to take care of me first, y'all, baby boomers? y'all be okay. I'm important first. Once I'm taking care of, okay. Y'all, okay.
No problem.
So getting it right means a couple things. It means that folk who want to simply get out and get a job have jobs there that are paying well. Other piece means if you want to go to school, grease that road as well. So I think both things have to be done. We don't need to shift folk into one or the other. but give folks the opportunity to have a more freedom of choice. So if folks choose to get a job, not because they got some huge ass debt, whereby they have to get a job to take care of it, right? So to me, it's doing both those things. That you do need to have a better functioning educational system. I mean, when I was a kid, I've been watching TV about how great California was, y'all. People, gone, y'all, okay? Which is devastating. It's just something definitely done in education in California. And it's not just, it's all the way around the country. You got to take care of that. So both has to be done. It's not an either or. And I mean, it's not, really, I don't want to get a rip on right now the stimulus package and so forth, but this whole fear about the size of spending is misplaced, y'all, okay? And the best way to understand that is to know that when we came out of World War II, which was the ultimate stimulus package, y'all, that ended the Depression, the ratio of the debt to the size of the economy, the GDP, was 125. In other words, we had roughly every dollar of our economy, our debt was 125. So this notion of, you know, debt may be maybe 65%, don't worry about it, y'all. Get it right, okay? I mean, the problem is the debt is not getting it right. You don't use your credit cards to go to McDonald's, right? That's getting it wrong. But you don't mind borrowing to get a house, perhaps, or to build the infrastructure to go forward. So my concern now with the kind of the current discussion, we keep focusing on all the spending, how we can pay it back. If the economy grows, we can pay it back, y'all. Because if your income doubles, you don't mind if I raise taxes by 10%, y'all. You still come ahead, right? The problem with tax hikes coming when your income is flat and want to raise taxes. So the story is get it right. And do what you got to do to get it right. And a last little personal analogy is one time I had walking pneumonia when I was back in the 20s, right? And instead of me staying off work for, you know, 2 weeks, I'm back to work real quick, right? I almost fell out. I didn't get it right, right? I tried to go back too soon and fell off again. I should have stayed out 2 weeks, get healthy, and go back to work. Same thing now. If you do a patchwork job now, if you don't do it right, then you can't pay it back. Because then your economy isn't strong, and you got the debt. So all hands should be, get the economy strong.
That's when you take that approach, when you mentioned earlier having an industry focus. And I look at certain industries, for example, like the auto industry, for a generation, black men were able to raise their families and raise from low income to middle class. And now these industries, for intents and purposes, are just collapsing. And so there's a whole generation of, black and brown families that have built their lives around these industries that don't exist anymore. What are you seeing in the landscape, in the labor market? How do we respond to that? You know, because I'm going back to, I've lost a job, and the industry I was working in no longer exists.
I wouldn't lie to you, Sean. Come on, it's crazy. I mean, the idea is, y'all, take a break, get the food, and come right back. Instead of drilling back and forth, maybe a 2-minute hiatus?
2 to 3 minutes, and then we're going to get started. We're back.
One I'll answer later on, but question is raised in the importance of history. Because a lot of what happens today around racial inequality is because of what's happened in the past. And the question is how much the knowledge of that is instructive in crafting new policies. And one, very important, short answer. But I think one thing we try to do at the Labor Center is have a philosophy that says, that people learn experientially. Okay? And so to me, it says that you learn by doing, and you try to engage folks and struggle around their interests, and in doing that, you expand people's horizons. And so my only concern is how we infuse history into that the organizing piece. That shouldn't be simply a classroom where Dr. Pitts says, back in the day, boom, 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 people's eyes glaze over, right? It's more a matter of, well, these are people who need to come together who want to come together to change their lives. How do we do that? And of course, in doing that, we sharpen ourselves, how we work with one another, what's our target, knowing those sort of lessons, those sort of things. So it's how you bring in history. That's going to be the important thing. That sometimes we don't bring in it very abstractly, like the book. And I mean, that's kind of how folks learn fundamentally. People learn by doing. So that's actually my only kind of a little bit of hesitation on that.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm actually an historian, and one of the challenges then becomes, if I'm too focused on what happened back in the day, what happened to my grandparents, what happened to my parents, does that bring in a paralysis? Or, and I think I caught some of what you were saying about sort of the anger that, you know, I didn't get mine, why is he getting his? You know, that history can be used as a way to divide, and how do we prevent that from happening as well? I think you're absolutely right. You don't want to just bang people over the head with a book, but you also don't want to create a situation of reinforcing ideas of I have been oppressed in this way, and therefore, because sometimes that can create a paralysis of moving forward too.
So, quick thought. I'm curious,
so we, as I mentioned, we have our Black Union Leadership Group, and one session is on immigration. And our goal in that session is just to get people a better sense of why folks came here. That's the main thing. End of the day, you know why they came here, I'm happy, okay? Very conflicted, y'all, because all the stuff comes out because folks have what I call this kind of pain over what's happening in our communities. End of the day, we need to get folk in motion to improve their lives. As you do that, folk become human all of a sudden. Because right now, when we don't engage real people, folk are caricatures. It's those folk took my job. But if also we can engage in people's lives, all of a sudden you become somebody who knows married, has a love, got some kids, struggling like I am, and we see points of unity. We can bring in the other stuff as well. So we can't be paralyzed, but I truly believe that all the stuff comes from the course of doing something. And when we don't, so we haven't got that kind of action component of that module. And so the weakness there, we kind of get stuck in the conversation. And I mean, I can't say you're wrong because that's your life, right? And your brother was in jail. I can't say he wasn't in jail. I mean, I can't. So I'm saying when we just have the talking component, people get not stuck. They are fully into their clear view of their lives and then how they project that on the world. And that, to me, how you begin to kind of move around that is engage the other. And see, not this kind of broad person caricature, you know, with that person. I use the example when I came back from Cleveland, California, got the whole Prop 8 thing. And I came off the airport in Oakland, and we were kissing. I said, that's what we need to see. Two people in love, showing love. With all this other kind of stuff we'll talk about, show a human being loving one another. It changes the dynamics. When there's this kind of caricature over what's somebody going to do to my kid and some strange thing that we don't know is going to actually happen, but also I get defensive. But you see a real folk there, it's a brand new world. And so that's what I would say. The question of how you do it is important. I want to get your feedback on some of this data stuff, y'all. This is kind of not that important. But by the way, that if you examine Black men, almost half are focused on simply three industries: manufacturing, wholesale retail trade, and public administration. Black women, 60% are in wholesale retail trade, education, health services, public administration. See a concentration by the way. What's important though is to gain a sense of the quality of pay of those industries. So what I try to do is kind of break folk out into thirds. I'm showing the lower third, by the way, but yeah, the idea you have kind of highest paid third Black workers. Well, you take each industry, divide into thirds, the question, where are Black folks in there? So in an ideal world, there'd be 33% of Black folks in the lower third, right? A third in the middle third, a third in the upper third. That's the ideal world. Then you come to America, right? Those are numbers, okay? And so you go back to those concentrated industries, we see that manufacturing, we have a lot of Black men, 46% are in the lower third. 39% lower third in retail, wholesale trade, 40% public administration, government and so forth. So the idea of giving a sense of this low wage work problem is an issue because we're stuck in the lower realms of these industries. So I'm going to quickly go through this stuff because I want to get to some things really important for me to get your feedback on. Just numbers on employment crisis, if you know about it, this is all pre-recession. Don't forget low wage work. In other words, in 2007, people, 42% of Black folks who work full-time earned less than $30,000. So they got out of bed every day, went to work every day, and couldn't pay the bills, y'all, basically. We can't ignore that problem there. Don't forget the long-term crises. next 3 hours, how about the top launching crises? Three big elements, people. We have very weak income growth between 1973 and today. We had a rising income inequality. Also, we had a gap between the growth in productivity, what we make as workers, and wage what we receive. And those are the three long-term crises. If I say get it right, you gotta get it right. So wages grow. So you don't have a big income gap. And so the kind of fruit of your labor is returned to people who work. An example of the first thing though. So between, if you look at the median black family income, between 46 and 73, it grew by 131%. So more than doubled people in 27 years. That was good growth, okay? Between 27 and 2004, 34 years, it only grew 33% people. That's the weak, anemic income growth. That's why I say we don't want to go back to a 1999 economy. Was Penn State product 1999? No, we don't want product 1964, maybe. I don't know. It's better music than anyway, okay? This is an interesting, kind of disturbing fact. So if you examine what happened between the fourth quarter of 07, fourth quarter of 08, we saw a rise in unemployment that we know, talk a lot about. We don't talk a lot about the second bullet point, that while we comprise 10.9% of the employed, we suffered 13.2% of job loss. And so once again, this is hitting us hard and harder than other folks. Okay. Globalization and place-based industries. Now, I'm trying to think of Pacer, y'all. So, one thing is conceptual. The old view, the dominant idea is job loss. Everywhere we turn, jobs are going overseas. To me, that is paralyzing. Because you move here, you get your butt beat. You move here, you get your butt beat. It's paralyzing. All you do, you go home, watch TV, right? I think a better view is we have a global redivision of work. In other words, back when I was a kid, for the most part, in kind of the Europe, United States, you had heavy manufacturing. You had resource extraction in, say, Latin America, Africa, parts of Asia. When you had manufacturing in China, that's the cheap stuff, right? So made in China was cheap stuff back in the day, y'all. Okay? That was the old division of work. Now you have a redivision of work now, where you see less and less manufacturing. I got to ask you a question, too. I'm sorry, we get to your question. I don't forget about your question. You have less and less manufacturing here, more servicing here. You have more manufacturing overseas. It means that some jobs are leaving. Can't dispute that. But some jobs are staying here. And we tend to ignore that. And new jobs are being born as well. I think that sort of more complicated view allows us to be more powerful because, wait a second, we kind of know what's happening and we can go with the flow and go in ways that they can be effective. And I'm not an expert by manufacturing, but my sense, y'all, some of this stuff ain't coming back. It's gone. I'm serious, it's gone forever. And people, it's hard to say. I'm not sure it's a bad thing, y'all. What's the expression we use? We don't live to work, we work to live. And so the concern, y'all, is paying the bills, not, you know, getting up and pleasing some man who's your boss, right? And so the issue is, how do you actually pay the bills? And if you think about this country, we think of being one big country. We're really 50 countries as one. And no state is self-sufficient. Maybe California in the old days, close to it, right? Maybe New York and Texas a little bit, right? We're interdependent. So what's happening now, people, and it's hard to kind of fully understand, grasp, is that we're broadening the scale of interdependency. So the problem isn't the job leaving. The problem is folks can't pay the bills when they leave. This changes the question, doesn't it? It changes how we approach it. If the longer, I'm not saying we shouldn't try to keep certain jobs, by the way. I'm trying to broaden and complicate the story. The goal is to have our kids live well. Have me retire well. That's the goal. Me, retirement, your kids, okay? And given that, we look at how we talk about job creation. How we talk about improving quality jobs. How we talk about public policy to achieve those goals. So the focus isn't the job, it's the quality of life we live, given a combination of job and social sector as well. So a different view of globalization. before the recession, it's all pre-recession stuff, right? The Bureau of Labor Statistics did analysis of job projections, and they said that about 53%, they said my little analysis, is about 54% of the job growth, the net job growth, occur in industries that are relatively place-based. So those four, wholesale, retail, trade, transportation, warehousing, utilities, education and health services, and leisure and hospitality. So that's what job growth is. So my thing is, well, people, how do we make those jobs better? Once again, because they ain't going anywhere. That's what the jobs are coming. How do we make those jobs the better jobs? Interesting, those four industries. Look at my whole segmentation by wages once again. We see, surprise, surprise, that we are disproportionately represented in the lower third of those staying industries. So once again, people, this is where the growth is. We are stuck in the bad jobs there. So the imperative is what? Make those jobs better. If they're going to be there, we're going to be there. We need to be in a better situation. And for that last row there, we're kind of a little bit better, kind of fair, right? 31%, 33%. Folks don't get paid with the doggone in the sector, okay? So in leisure and hospitality, if we have my little cutoff wage, the top cutoff in the lower third was roughly $8 an hour, y'all. And so it's simply a low-paying industry right now that we got to make better. My approach is, my idea, once again, people, this is where the job growth is. This is where we are. We're in the lowest segment there. Struggle how to improve those things.
Well, you have the intersection of immigration. There's a coalition, I believe it's called Immigration Works, and they're representatives of these very industries that are now lobbying to bring in guest workers. Okay.
And also, and how do you improve the jobs or make the jobs better? Is there a route other than unionization or through unions, or is that the sole?
It's two broad things. Let me get away from kind of the label that stuff. You need to have a structure that works better. Labor standards. And so if we didn't have a minimum wage, we know what happened to wages, right? If we didn't say kids got to go to school, they wouldn't go to school. We have laws to kind of create better behavior. So we need those laws to have better things happen in the labor market. Second, we need to have groups of people have more power there. Now, given how we organize our laws here, this is called a union. That if you begin to engage in collective bargaining, you're a union. I don't know what you call yourself. That's what you are, what you do, okay? NEA. You're going to be a union, okay? You need to empower people collectively in the workplace or have laws to allow for better behavior. Those are two broad strategies. Now, we can be creative in those two ways. I don't mind that. I'm not sure what a third way is given those two things. I get messed up here. Well, the thing before then is immigration. Oops, fly. Anyway, we're supposed to be immigration. Now, the idea is that the challenge, the changes are really acute in our neighborhoods because all the changes are there, right? Where we have both kind of the unfinished revolution, but also you have kind of changing racial terrain. I call it in space, identity and power. And so I would spend a long time in Houston, Texas. And people, I don't know if you've been there, but huge history of black, old black high schools fighting one another, right? Football. It was Yates High School and Wheatley High School, y'all. Okay? Historical black high school. Major events on Thanksgiving Day, y'all. When I left Houston in 2001, they had Spanish on the marquee at Wheatley, y'all. Now, that's a loss, because your thing is, we were raised on Yates and Wheatley being some black school. They speak in Spanish. That's a loss there that people feel it intensely, okay? Change identity. You call some things not what they used to be. And then all of a sudden, you know, these black seats in Congress, they ain't black no more, y'all. Getting black folks there. That's a change in power dynamic there that we got to deal with. So the idea that these changes are particularly acute in our communities is a complicated response, because I think it's not so much a matter of not knowing history. It's more, once again, it's a memory of the unfinished revolution. There are people still in pain. It's also the current crises, right, that's going on here. And lastly, there's no good movement to change things. So we have really a complicated situation. But here's some numbers here and data. People, a couple things first. if we look at the question of low-wage labor markets, that fundamental question of local and regional labor markets, because folk don't move that much. They stuck in New York City, right? They stuck in Chicago. You're not going to see somebody, a security guard, who's guarding Empire State Building, going to check out Garden, Transamerica Building in San Francisco, y'all. Not going to happen, right? And so it means that the analysis must be metropolitan focused. Get a better sense of what's happening here. I'm going to try to tell some broad stories, contextualize things, to put an anecdote in different situations here. And let me know how this flows, y'all. I'm kind of, you're my guinea pig, so bear with me on this. First, there's not a direct correlation between measures of black labor market outcomes and level of immigrant workers. Let me show you that, I think, fairly convinced. I liked it, at least, so I hope y'all like it, too. The idea is this, though. The story says this. As they come, we're worse off. That's the story, bottom line. If that was the case, you expect to find, as we see cities with larger and larger immigrant populations, you'd find more and more black distress. Because when they come, we're worse off. Didn't happen, y'all. So, we did a lot of stuff. I got like 12 things I can show you, but I can show you a couple. We took the yes. Oh, we can talk about how folk get jobs. How are you defining outsourcing? Because typically it's talking about going around, leaving the country. We say outsourcing typically. You have jobs here. If you looked at the number of jobs in the United States, there are more jobs here now than there were 30 years ago. So the question is not the number of jobs, it's the type of jobs. That's part of the anecdote. One, make sure it's clear, people. No, it's important. That's part of that. No, it's an important conversation.
I was going to say, give her the mic. I'm sorry.
You can come on my quick response. So step one, we focus on the job loss. We ignore the job creation. What happens in our country is job churning, where jobs go away and jobs come. So, and on net, once again, there are more jobs here now than were 30 years ago. Issues the type of jobs. Now, what I was saying, and maybe I was misplacing my emphasis, that when the story is kind of the tensions between blacks and immigrants, oftentimes the narrative is, as they come, we're worse off. That's what I meant, simply, in the context of a city. What we did is we took the 20 metropolitan areas with the largest black populations, okay? And we examined different measures of black distress and immigrant presence. I'm going to show you a couple. We're going to stack on the far column immigrant presence, right? Foreign-born and workforce. The idea should be, as there are more and more of those folk, we're worse off, right? How do I measure distress? That's looking at the proportion of full-time black workers who are making under $30,000. That's distress, y'all. What we see there is that while in Birmingham, the foreign-born workforce is 4.3%, full-time workers under 30,000, 47%. As you go up the ladder there, we don't see rising amounts of distress. Those are the first 10. Same story, y'all, okay? You go up the ladder of immigrant presence, we don't see rising distress. There's not a clear correlation. I'm not saying there's no connection. There's no clear correlation between immigrant presence and black job distress.
But you're looking at black employees. What about black unemployed?
Well, then you flip the switch. So we are a conference in Baltimore, and I didn't have this here, so I took care of it now. I learned from mistakes.
I'm actually going to ask you to go back because I just want to clarify.
Too late.
No?
Because
I'm looking there, and I mean, this, if I'm reading it right, and statistics are not my strong suit, I can read. But it looks to me like in actually in places where there are larger immigrant populations or foreign-born in the workforce, according to that, black folks are actually doing better in like San Francisco and New York City than they're doing in places like that. But did you also correlate for regional industry? Because my guess is that folks in Birmingham are not earning as much as they would have been in some of these places where the economy continued to churn and improve in ways that they weren't. It wasn't in other places. I'm just picking out Birmingham.
We didn't adjust for regional cost of living, which is part of what you're saying. Mainly here, not to say the reverse is the case. I'm saying the story is inaccurate. It's a complicated story. So we tell simple stories. The world is complicated. That's all I'm trying to say. And we could bring in the kind of regional cost of living. It wouldn't bring it that much differently, by the way. Okay?
Well, what about the characteristics of the immigrant? Are you conflating illegal and legal immigrants?
Undocumented? Yeah. They're all put together. But, yeah, they are. But, I mean, okay, y'all. Miami. Okay? I'm assuming a lot of folks there may miss some papers. Okay? L.A.
What's the definition?
Well, I disagree with that. No big issue there.
Well, I agree with that.
That's fine. Cool. We're still friends, though. No problem. But just use those to see, for example, the last four cities, right? You don't see a clear correlation there. You know there are a lot of folks there who either come illegal, come no papers, statements there, right? So it's not you could pull them apart in the same story to be told. What we did later on is we talked about the how recent they've been here. So this is the entire workforce. We did another, it's not on the slide here, we took the proportion of people who came here since 2000, since 1990. So that makes a different kind of mix there. The same story. There's no correlation. The report will show
no clear correlation. Not there's no correlation. No clear or direct. There's a difference.
Okay.
I'm a lawyer.
Okay. Now, we're correlating two variables here. And with these two variables, there's no correlation between the two. Okay? There's no correlation between those two variables. Now, we mentioned one complication, looking at regional cost of living. We discussed other complications. I would bet my soul the story is the same. There's no correlation. Now, there may be in certain industries, occupations. That's where we get the next part of my data here, okay? The issue is across the board. My fear is this. We take an occupation and we universalize it. That's what I'm saying. So the idea is to say our simple stories are inaccurate. Let's complicate the stories. That's all I'm trying to do, okay? That's all I'm trying to try to say. Simple stories don't work. They aren't accurate, okay? And once again, we took four measures of immigrant presence. We took three measures of black distress. So there's 12 charts, 20 cities, y'all. I'll give you, 12 times 20 scatter diagrams. Ain't no coalition, y'all, okay? So, yes, for unemployment. So same story, okay? I mean, exact same story. You have no coalition there. No coalition. I'll call it direct. Allow the simple story to run our stories, because that is inaccurate. And so that's part one of the data. Is that okay, though, by the way? If we have some other questions on this, other stuff is harder to read. Now, part two, this is, that's the data, isn't it? How's the word unclear? Okay. This is what I did. If I have occupations wrong. And so what I did is this. I stratified the black workforce by pay in thirds, right? Upper thirds, middle third, and lower third. And then I said, well, I still can't deal with this, you know, Hunnismon. Let me take the top 10. So I'm looking at the lower third of the pay scale for black folks. I took the top 10 occupations in that strata, okay? Now, for information, that captured about 23% of all black workers. So once again, if you examine these 10 occupations, and these are the top 10, the largest numerically, in the bottom rung, the bottom third, bottom tercile, those 10 occupations in 1980, I apologize, y'all. So we're going from 80 to 2007. So in 80, they comprised about a fifth of the entire black workforce. They comprised about 60% of all the lower third workers. So you sense what we're looking at, okay? And what I'm trying to give you a sense of is where we were in 80 the change in 2007, okay? So the first thing you see that, for instance, janitors. There are 9,426 janitors, black janitors, in 1980. Boom. By 2005, that rose by 2%. So step one says more black janitors, y'all. It's interesting. That's all spoke Spanish, right? Another conversation. So we see between 1980 and 2007, there's more black janitors. And the next column is the black share of that occupation. So we see that while there are more black janitors were a lower proportion in 2007 than they were in 1980. That may be a sign of displacement. So I'm trying to figure out how do you measure displacement? People, this term is done in a neutral way. It's a norm-neutral term. There in point period A, not there in B. No norms involved, y'all, okay? I'm calling job displacement. When we're measuring simply, do we maintain our share? It's not the number because the economy is growing. It's the share. And so we see that for janitors, our share is less. Okay? It's less in 2007. We see an incredible increase and black and Latino janitors. Okay? We see that even in looking at Latino janitors, well, Latinos made up a larger share of all janitors between 80 and 2005. What's fascinating, and I just kind of racialized, almost all these occupations are fewer white folks, y'all. The share is less. It's like, I mean, it's like we're fighting over crumbs. They go in other places, by the way. That's another conversation. Okay. In other words, we see that the white share in all the occupations have fallen. Yeah. Then you see the number of the change overall. In other words, there are 17.5% more janitors now than 1980. You see what I'm getting at? Does that make sense now? So if we accept, and I want to ask you, I'm not saying this is the case, if we accept the notion of a reduction in our share as an example of displacement, we see that in three occupations we see displacement. Janitors, housekeepers and maids, and farm workers. In the other seven, we don't see displacement because we have increased our share. Now, this is a test run. So if it flows well, I'm not totally stupid. So y'all be analytical, please. It may not be good. Okay? And so I am testing on this stuff, how it works for you. I don't know. I have all this data, how to process data. That to me is a starting point to examine the issue of displacement. We haven't looked at causal issues. We don't know why it's happening. It may be a number of things. It may be we're going to a better job, by the way, y'all. Because, I mean, in the old days, we wouldn't fight over being a janitor. If we didn't fight over being a housekeeper, by the way, in the old days, that wasn't one where I kind of put the flag down and go down to death being a housekeeper. And so maybe we're in better jobs, actually. But I'm not saying yes, no on that. I'm simply saying that if our metric for displacement is a lower black share in occupation. In those two occupations, we see three displacements, seven we don't.
Are you including African immigrants in that as well?
By the way, one problem with these numbers, folk got to tell the truth and like your categories. And what I mean is this, when I was doing some stuff, playing around trying to find the black Hispanic population, and I looked at New York City, there are very few black Hispanics. So listen, y'all, I know Washington Heights, y'all crazy. There's a lot of black Hispanics. So we went deeper into it. And the problem is that when they go to the racial category, Dominicans don't say they're black.
No, neither do they. Whoa. Stuff like this, right?
People, no judgment right now, y'all. Just saying that. I mean, no, just saying that.
I have some Indians who won't say they're black.
Right.
But the main thing is no judgment call, y'all. Just saying that our numbers are flawed.
Yeah.
When we try to talk about this whole black ethnicity stuff, which is very crucial. The numbers are flawed. They simply are.
For what it's worth, I'm with the Association of Black Foundation Executives. We focus on how philanthropy can impact black communities, right? Raising investment in these communities to address disproportionality. Your numbers strike me in a very profound way because you have quantified this decrease in share. And this is something that prior to seeing something like this has only come up in various forms of anecdotal conversations. So it's powerful in that sense. And then when we compare it to Latino and the majority population, it becomes even more profound when we start to have initiatives like black and brown male effort. So just as a little bit of feedback, there's a lot of value in that. Thank you.
I did it again. So before I kind of stratify the pay scale, this is the entire pay scale, the top 10 black occupations, I mean where we are the most, okay? So different slides, a lot of same folk are there, right? But the same way you interpret the numbers. So how are we going to measure displacement? Look at the reduction in job share. So this slice, we see, was it five? Five plates we see displacement. Janitors, machine operators, laborers, primary school teachers, and maids, okay?
Black women and black men, primarily in public administration, it was like the top three. So those probably would be civil service positions, like some of, like secretary.
You're saying that who employs the secretaries?
No, I was just trying to correlate in the fact that you mentioned earlier or you shared with us that I think
So clearly, you know, we have two ways of looking at the world. We have industries that I gave you before as occupations. Folk who work across same occupation across industries. For the most part, you can find the primary school teachers under education and health services. Okay? For the secondary to be across the board, though. And we could, give them more data, slice it up. How many secretaries in public administration versus manufacturing, boom, 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 boom. This is put all together, irrespective of the industry.
Steve, I just want to do a time check. We have about 15 minutes.
Almost done, too. Almost done. But y'all can go to 5 o'clock, though, right?
Operators, NEC?
Oh, not elsewhere classified.
Oh, okay.
Well, Census Bureau So I'm just trying to give a story. The one, I think it tells a story. Before I kind of big and bold and bad, now I'm kind of back a little dumb stuff, y'all. Because I'm not really clear. I'm trying to process this data. There's a lot to try to go through. So I want to get you to get, is it read okay? Does a thing, I have more stuff, by the way. Because we have all this stuff for blacks and whites and Latinos and overall. So we have both the importance of an occupation for population. In other words, how many black workers, what proportion of black workers are in janitors and so forth. I have that, but I didn't show because we have limited space. We also have the wages too, which means an interesting add-on to see what happened to wages where we see displacement and those sort of things. I just couldn't, see a clear story. I couldn't put it on a PowerPoint slide anyway, so I just said, don't worry about it. So we have more data out there that can be generated to kind of tell more stories. What I also did, but I ran out of time to put it out here, is we did the largest Latino occupations as well. My memory is we saw more displacement, but I didn't fully, this is occupation mode right now, so I didn't fully focus on that. So there's a lot of slides that we could take of this stuff. But I think it's beginning to tell a useful story, I think.
Can you tell one more story based on mid-slide, speaking of different occupations than janitor, and just walk me through what these seven or eight different columns mean?
Looking at machine operators, not elsewhere classified. We see there are fewer black workers there. So parentheses means negative. So it fell by 38.8%. We see that the black share fell, went up a whole bunch. Okay, it fell by 0.8%. So we see fewer black machinists, machine operators. We see blacks contain or make up a small proportion, a slight small proportion of the machinist workforce. We see there are more Latinos in the machine operator category, and they are a larger share. Just a change now, not the absence, change in share, rose by 9.7%. As I said, white folks took off. The white folks aren't machine operators anymore. They dropped by 46%. But the number dropped by 46%. The share dropped by, the occupation dropped by 13%. Interesting, we see that overall in the country, there are fewer machine operators. So part of the story is that part of what drives a change in the numbers is a larger economic change. So this is going away from the idea of displacement. Just saying that, well, guess what? Overall, the fewer machine operators, black folks here, right? The fewer black machine operators as well. So what I'm not glad to tell quick stories of is how to kind of bring together both the ethic change and the kind of industry's change. Now, we're working that, called a shift share analysis. We're working that a little bit, so hopefully folks can pull that out, but hasn't done yet, so you haven't got it yet. So does that make sense how I'm walking through?
It does. I mean, I think in terms of the machine operators, it helps me understand while there's been a decrease in the number of black workers in that occupation, there's similarly been a decrease. If we assume that Latinos are the proxy, you know, are the label here for immigrants, which is complicated, more complicated than that. But we recognize that there's an increase in the Latino share in that line of work. There's been not only a decrease of black workers, but also white workers in that line of work. Helps me. I think going back to your point of, and I studied economics, and math is definitely my, and spreadsheets are more my domain than Microsoft Word and literature. I'd be curious what the, not the percentages and not the trends, but therefore what does that mean in terms of hundreds of thousands or millions of workers underneath? Because I think it's the percentage, you know, I think just being able to see the raw number, if in 2007 there were this many black workers in these 10 industries relative to this many millions of Latino workers.
I was getting onto that form. Yeah. What's interesting also, cooks. So we would say black folks ain't cooking, right, except for some TV shows, right? But look what's happening. We see more black cooks now than we were in 1980. Okay? We see a slightly higher share. Okay? Reason being, overall, there are more cooks in society, about 80 to 70%. And so sometimes, because we focus on anecdotes, we don't see larger trends. That's kind of the takeaway. This stuff is complicated, y'all. That your story is your story. I value you. I love you. But guess what? It's your story, y'all, in the conversation. You need to talk about a broader story and see a more complicated story. But in my mind, the issue is not so much the data. It's how do you organize to improve people's lives given that. That's why I kind of shy on this stuff here. Because we can all go sleep on data. It's more a matter of given how do we take people's real lives and make them better. But two things I'm important I want to say, though. Kind of summing some things up. Job training is important, but not good enough. We need a more complete approach. Ways to transform low-wage jobs, but also need to find ways to transform the prospects for unemployed people as well, getting into good jobs. Some broad strategies, just some thoughts. It's all for important people, okay? We got to get public policies that's going to maintain raise labor standards. A really powerful book called Wage Theft in America by Kim Bobo. She talks about the amount of simple wage theft, where you punch off the clock and you keep on working, y'all. I'm serious. You punch off and you keep on working. And what concerns me is that I'm positive that our folk suffer that. But because we don't focus on folk who work, we don't raise it to the surface. So it's not a black issue because, no, we don't talk about it. We talk about folk who need a job. But I bet you if you go into some of these small churches, these suffering churches, folk kind of, you know, barely got 10% to put in the kitty, but do it anyway. And I know they face this stuff, y'all. So the issue is how to raise these questions and protect those folks. Find ways to link jobs as black to pipelines to good jobs. May not happen overnight, but you got to say, okay, I understand folks ain't going to walk into no serious money, but show me the pipeline. Don't give me the rhetoric on the ladder. Show me the ladder. And I don't want ladders rungs, you know, 10 feet apart. I can't climb that ladder. I mean rungs that I can do. Every year, I'm up and wrong. Now it's important sort of work to talk, but not to say, but to actually do. This is my pet I love to do, but I'm only one person. I haven't got a twin yet. To engage the black faith community and other segments around workplace concerns of black community members. That people, it's not about those folks, our folks. Just ask them, what's happening? Some people don't have jobs. Some folks are hustling, y'all. Some folks got jobs. They aren't paying well. We got to talk about it in the churches and so forth. And also when you do that, that's a conversation. We can talk about now how to get it better. When we don't have a conversation, you can't talk about making it. Because no one talks. It's kind of visible in many ways. On conversation people. But this is really super important. The whole thing about how if one person is a slave, we're all slaves. The same thing, y'all, okay? That one thing is depressing wages, that people are super exploited. And so we stop that and stop the super exploitation. And so that's my little, that's the longer conversation, another brown bag lunch. So find me another good jazz concert, okay? I'll come up for that, we're doing the brown bag lunch, okay? But also, there's some ways that we see changes in the industry. So one thing that's happening is a lot of subcontracting. As you have all the subcontracting, you're bearing the responsibility. So I'm the top dog person. I obey the law, right? That's the contract. That's the contract. And the subcontract. And the final subcontract, what he's doing, he or she is doing, he is locking workers in the building at night. So you clean the building at night, you can't get out. You lock the doors. You're changing the industry where the responsibility is diffused down. We can't find those folks. We got to find ways to stop that. You know, in some countries, you can't hire contingent workers. That's an idea. To stop the stuff from happening, y'all. Okay, so the idea is how to help industries behave better for workers. That should be another slide, anyway. I'm getting more and more thought of is that, you know, Obama didn't run an explicit black campaign. The folk knew who he was, right? The folk got on board, right? It had a black sensibility, and folk kind of this role. If you talk bad about him, you got shot, right? Now, I shouldn't go that far. But I'm saying, though, you need to have a movement on the job with black sensibilities. When I say union, you think white folks. That's part of the problem. I understand what's happening. That's what goes on now. We need a black-oriented view around move around jobs. And that has to happen. So, one, we get on board, and we know that's taking care of our people, and we address those unique concerns. And lastly, I know what's happening in California, but I bet it's happening here as well. There's not a lot of what I'll call grassroots organizing efforts in the black community. We have a lot of service stuff going on, but people is very important, very, very important. But we need a complement of actually organizing. What happens is that we get this people of color. And if I say black folk run up the hills, okay, and we got somehow put back against that, where we say that it's legitimate to say we need to build bases in black communities, transform the world. It's legitimate and it's sacred. It has to happen. And I truly believe if you don't do that, you won't get the larger vision. You're going to have a hole in the rainbow. More important, folks are going to push back on the vision. And so I would say those two things about moving forward. How do you get this kind of black sensibility around jobs going on? You know, and people, it won't stay black because the world is not only black, y'all. It won't stay. So that's kind of, tell folks, don't get afraid. Okay, they won't stay black because the world is not all black. But if you have a black sensibility, folks will get on board. Okay, it won't be simply, I know you kind of halfway, but I really believe in you. And lastly, we got to have stuff in the community that's really going to do some serious work. My last little pet peeve is New Orleans. I don't know how Reverend Jefferson got reelected.
Jefferson. Mm-hmm. 90.
For organizing. Because folks either zoned out because of a catastrophe, they allow that man who know is wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, y'all know that stuff is wrong, right? You got that's a lack of organizing. And that's our business that we got to take care of. And that's a matter of spending resources to do that, basically. You'd be our poster child for needing some organizing. And that should be it, y'all. You got it, 2 o'clock, right?
Right on time. Let's thank Stephen Pitts for his insights and analysis. And he's a very accessible, and I really appreciate on behalf of the campaign and the Open Society Institute, Stephen, you coming in on your vacation to share your work, and we're looking forward to hearing more, particularly around the development of the Black Labor Center and how that work is inspiring what you're doing. And also, you ended with organizing, and just we're looking forward to hearing more about your efforts in organizing Black labor leaders around this work. So we thank you.